Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
A rested child is a happy child. Sleep Tight Stories is a weekly podcast that brings comfort and joy to families worldwide with calming bedtime stories. The stories are relevant to children and spark wonder without overstimulation, so they can fall asleep and stay asleep. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. For a bedtime routine you'll miss when they're grown, Sleep Tight Stories.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick. And Rob and I are out this week, so we're bringing you an episode from The Vault. This is sort of part four in our series that we started re-airing last week about throwing behaviors in non-human animals. But here we're getting, of course, to the emergence of throwing behaviors in humans and human ancestors. Hope you enjoy. And oh, this one originally published January 12th, 2023.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part four of our series on throwing behavior. Now, in previous parts, we focused mainly on non-human animals. We've looked at alleged throwing behaviors in octopuses, in elephants, in the mongoose. We definitely had a digression about dogs with Air Bud in the previous episode, but also in the previous episode, we ended up talking about the evolution of the human capacity for throwing, which we are particularly apt at. Humans are very good at throwing, especially compared to our nearest primate relatives. So like a chimpanzee may be on average three or four times stronger than a human, but a human, even without specialized training, can generally throw a lot more forcefully and a lot better than a chimpanzee can. So why are we so specialized for throwing? Well, we took a look at some evolutionary hypotheses about where our capacity for throwing comes from. But there was another thing that I came across while researching this subject that I did not get into in the previous episode, and I wanted to come back to it here because I found it really interesting. And this is the idea of, what if the evolution of throwing was somehow a necessary precursor for the evolution of probably the most distinctly human trait, language? So not just that humans are good at throwing and good at language, but that there is actually a neurobiological link between the two. One comes from the other. So to look at this question, I wanted to refer to a paper by William D. Hopkins, Jamie L. Russell, and Jennifer A. Schaefer, published in Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B, Biological Sciences, published in 2012, called The Neural and Cognitive Correlates of Aimed Throwing in Chimpanzees, a Magnetic Resonance Image and Behavioral Study on a Unique Form of Social Tool Use. So to begin, they cover some of the same ground we did in the previous episode, how unusual human throwing behavior is in a way. And despite all the interesting examples we've discussed in these episodes of animals throwing things for various reasons, whether trained by humans or just doing it as part of their natural instinctual behaviors, the authors here argue that in general, throwing remains unsystematic, in their words, in other animals. And I think this is fair. No other animal practices the kind of generalized, skillful, habitual throwing that we do. Certainly not without training by humans.
Yeah, as we discussed in the previous episode, it goes way back in human behavior. And it's something that even today, with all our other tools and ways of doing things at a distance, we still engage in throwing. I think in the very first episode, we discussed that sort of, at least in my case, the strange pull to need to throw a ball with my son when he was younger. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, we're not a baseball or softball family, but it was just kind of this thing that I guess was like nostalgic in the culture, but also very satisfying to do. Mm-hmm. And something that even if you're not very practiced at, you can do with some, or at least I found that I could do with some degree of precision, despite being very rusty at the whole softball baseball thing.
I totally sympathize with you there. I mean, I think neither of us are really sports guys. I don't really want rules. I don't really want teams, but I do want ball.
Mm-hmm.
Or frisbee. Frisbee, just as good, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I mean, there's also a lot more throwing that goes on, too. Like, how often do we find ourselves across the room from someone? We request something and they give it a toss. They throw it to us. And you want to be able to catch it for various reasons. And then that's without even getting into the various sports that even if we don't engage in, we may watch. And the throwing of balls is often an essential part or at least one aspect of a given sport.
Right. But of course, apart from these recreational concerns, you know, throwing has been crucial to the survival of our ancestors. That seems pretty clear. And in the last episode, we talked about arguments from evolutionary anthropology that throwing was positively selected for in human ancestors, and the bodies of hominin species like Homo erectus show anatomical changes that seem to favor forceful overhand throwing. Remember those changes? They're like changes in the shoulder and the waist and the upper arm, all of which mm-hmm. combine to allow for a more substantial wind up, sort of a pulling back of tension of the biomechanical bowstring to be released rapidly during the throw. And we also talked about the argument that these changes appear to coincide with evidence of meat becoming a bigger part of the diet of these hominins, showing that throwing was likely useful for obtaining food either through power scavenging, like driving predators away from a kill in order to take the meat for yourself, or direct hunting, and either way, increasing the availability of food energy. Now, one very interesting thing about the adaptation for throwing is that it implies not only changes in the muscles and the skeletal system. Of course, you know, you can see all those changes around the scapula and the shoulder blade, changes in the waist, the arm, and so forth. But it also implies changes in cognition. An animal that can throw objects sourced from the environment is showing a specialized way of thinking and not just a specialized way of moving. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, as one example, the authors reference a specific captive chimpanzee who came up in the last episode. Rob, you remember the story of Santino, the chimpanzee mm-hmm. who was in a zoo in, I believe, Sweden, was it?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Santino.
Yeah, poor Santino. The authors write that Santino, who I guess was alive at the time this paper was written, quote, hides rocks out of sight of the care staff, waiting to reveal and throw them at approaching visitors at the most opportune time. Evidence of planning comes from the observation that Santino searches for the rocks from a moat inside the enclosure prior to the arrival of the care staff and the visitors and caches the rocks out of sight only to pull them out when the visitors arrive. That is a crafty chimp, and that is forethought.
Mm-hmm.
Adding to this, the authors throw in their own observations of similar pre-planning behavior in chimpanzees in two other research environments. And they argued that the throwing, quote, though often agonistic in function and consequence, agonistic meaning a sort of confrontational, aggressive behavior, is not part of the ape's display behavior. Indeed, most instances of aimed throwing that we have observed occur without any accompanying display behaviors such as piloerection, hooting, and charging, further suggesting an element of planning on the part of the individual ape. So I think that's interesting, too, if you understand what they're saying there, that there is a sort of standard display behavior algorithm, like when an ape is doing an agonistic display when trying to be dominant and aggressive and maybe scare you off.
Mm-hmm.
It includes all of these sub-features, like the piloerection, meaning the bristling of body hair, hair stands on end, hooting, charging back and forth, all that stuff. And they say that when the apes throw stuff at people, they do it without all of these other features of a typical instinctual display. Another way that throwing is different from most other forms of tool use in apes, the most commonly observed types of tool use by wild chimpanzees are all things where the tool is used to extract otherwise unreachable food, often like from a hole or enclosure of some kind, and then is eaten immediately. So examples here would be cracking of nuts with stones, like nut cracking is an example of ape tool use, but also termite fishing with sticks, ant dipping, and so forth. All of these give rise to an immediate food reward for executing the behavior, meaning that these behaviors are subject to regular operant conditioning rules. If a behavior leads to an immediate food reward, an animal can learn to repeat basically any arbitrary set of actions. So, you know, a chimpanzee gets delicious termites every time it, of course, if it dips for them, that's one thing. But maybe if it stands on one foot and gets termites every time, it may learn to stand on one foot to get the meat.
Yeah, and we see this reflected in so many experiments involving animals over the years. You know, can you get an animal to manipulate some sort of technological gadget in order to get a food reward?
Yeah, pressing a button or something that would have no relevance in the natural environment. Mm-hmm. So other tool use behaviors could easily be learned and reinforced through this kind of conditioning, but throwing, as practiced by apes, does not lead to an immediate food reward. In fact, it rarely, if ever, leads to a food reward at all. The authors write, quote, "What appears to be the main reward for throwing is the simple ability to control or manipulate the behavior of the targeted individual, ape or human," which, though you could consider it a goal, I mean, that is much more complicated and ambiguous than a direct food reward.
Yeah, because it's not like the ape in this scenario is throwing the rock, hitting the human, and then by hitting the human, they drop an apple or something.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, from here, the authors go on to discuss the underappreciated complexity of throwing. We also talked about this at length in the previous episode, but, you know, suffice to say, forceful, precise overhand throwing is an extremely demanding task, not only for the muscles, but for the brain, requiring split-second coordination of perceptual judgments, all kinds of things. You know, how far away is the target? Is it moving? In what direction and how fast? What are the physical properties of the projectile and so forth? But then the other thing is the sequential motor control. To throw an object, you have to precisely time a rapid sequence of muscular movements. And other authors have previously suggested that, quote, "the increased selection for neural synchrony of rapid muscular sequencing routines associated with actions such as throwing are similar to the motor programming demands of language and speech, and therefore engage similar neural systems, notably Broca's area." Mm-hmm. In other words, there are similarities between what the brain is doing and what parts of the brain are being used to coordinate a throw and to process language and perform speech. And one idea that gets wrapped up in this is the role of brain lateralization, segmenting of brain processes to one hemisphere or side of the brain or the other. So in cultures where throwing behavior has been studied, the authors say the majority of people pretty much always prefer to throw with the right hand. Studies in chimpanzees also show a bias toward right-handedness for throwing. And these right-hand preferences suggest left hemisphere dominance in the brain in these majorities of both populations. Because when it comes to controlling the body's movements, of course, you know, the hemispheres are flipped. Generally, the left hemisphere links to the right hand, the right hemisphere to the left, and so forth. Some researchers have pointed this out in the context of the fact that the left hemisphere also contains the brain regions, notably Broca's area, that dominate the production of speech. Broca's area is also known as the motor speech area. And one researcher who has focused on this is the American neurophysiologist William H. Calvin, who was, or actually, I think maybe still is, a professor at the University of Washington at Seattle, who, observing that 89% of people prefer to throw with the right arm, Calvin hypothesized that the left hemisphere's capacity for language may have actually evolved from a pre-existing adaptation for right-handed throwing. He apparently published a book that contained this hypothesis in 1983. It was called The Throwing Madonna.
Oh, then they adapted this into the film A League of Their Own, right?
Was Madonna in that?
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, okay. Was she the pitcher in the movie?
I don't remember. But, I mean, surely she threw a ball at least once. I mean, there's a lot of throwing in baseball.
Yeah, you throw no matter what position you are. I guess the pitcher throws the most.
There's no crying in baseball, but there is throwing in baseball.
There's a lot.
That much I remember from the film.
Okay, so Madonna was definitely throwing no matter what position she played. No, but it unfortunately did not become the basis of the movie, as far as I know. Instead, it was a place where Calvin laid out an interesting sort of story, a possible series of developments that could have led to the development of language via the stepping stone of capacity for throwing. So the story goes like this. Lateralization evolved for one-handed throwing with the right hand specifically so that parents, typically mothers, could cradle an infant on their left side, and then they'd be free to throw with the right hand if they needed to. So, I mean, obviously things like this are hard to prove for sure, but that is an interesting idea because I started thinking about how I recently became a father, and without thinking about it at all, I pretty much always, when I hold my baby, hold her on the left side of my torso. And so if she like falls asleep against me, her head is going to be on the left side of my chest. And that from my point of view, which is also the side where the heartbeat is closer. I never planned it that way. That just sort of happened. And I was talking to my wife and she said, yeah, most often she's on the left side there too. So I don't know. That's kind of interesting. I mean, it could be totally unrelated, but I don't know.
Yeah. I would always scoop up on the left side as well. My son is now, I think, finally too big for me to do that without seriously injuring myself. But yes.
And I guess at a certain point, you become less desiring of the heartbeat sound that like maybe loses some of the power it has over really young infants.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it varies from child to child. Depends on how big they get and at what point they want that distance. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, well, so it's hard to know for sure if the need to scoop a child and hold them on the left side of the body close to the heartbeat is the real reason driving brain lateralization. I find it more compelling than some other hypotheses that seem to be on offer at the time. One that cited, I was reading a review of this book by Calvin that cited a previous hypothesis that right-handedness evolved because men in battle, I guess prehistoric battle, needed to like hold a shield above their heart on the left side. And I was like, all right, get out of here.
This discussion reminds me of a painting, an 1888 painting that I hadn't thought of in a bit. I believe what is this? The title of this piece is Two Mothers by Léon-Maxime Favre. If I'm pronouncing that correctly, it's F-A-I-V-R-E. But it's a pretty stunning piece in which we see this vision of a prehistoric mother with very modern touches to it. But she's standing here in some sort of a hide garment, and she has this heavy-looking infant in her left arm, and then there's another child sort of hanging on to her left arm. In her right hand, she has looks like some sort of a stone weapon, like a wooden haft with a stone blade, some sort of primitive axe or club. Mm-hmm. And she's staring back into the shadows behind her with this kind of like cave environment, and there's clearly an animal lurking there, an animal emerging from the shadows. And I think this is supposed to be the other mother, the mother that is hunting her. And I have no idea if this piece has any connection to what we're talking about here. But it is interesting that we do see left arm cradling children, right arm brandishing a weapon to protect those children against some threat.
It is a kind of beautiful painting. Yeah.
Yeah. Her hair is perfect, too. Like, this mom's really got it together. Perfect hair, protecting the children, ready to brain a panther with some sort of a stone weapon.
Anyway, whatever the cause of the right-hand lateralization for sequential motor control in throwing, the hypothesis goes on from here to suggest that sequential motor control regions that made us so good at tossing a stone with one hand were eventually commandeered by selection pressure for communication and shifted to a different kind of sequential motor control, which was language production. Now, when we think of language production, we think of speech, and that could be the case. I think Calvin argued for a transitional stage where the original language was more gesture-based, like gesturing with the hands maybe, which would have then transitioned into speech production with the mouth. Again, like many things here, that's not something we know for sure. So we're in very speculative territory, but I do find this really interesting. So again, if there's anything to this story, it would go that for some reason, there is an original right hand, left brain motor lateralization for the majority of the population for throwing objects. Human ancestors get really good at throwing with that one hand, maybe cradling a baby in the other arm or doing something else. And then you could argue that the lateralization for precise sequential motor activity in the left brain to power throwing eventually provides the neurological scaffolding for the left brain's capacity for language and speech. Now, what was the actual experiment in this study? Well, it was looking at our closest primate relatives to see if they could provide any insight on what might have been going on in the brains of very distant human ancestors. So they were looking at chimpanzees. Now, again, chimpanzees don't throw nearly as well or as often as we do, but some throw sometimes. So what, if anything, is different in the brains of chimpanzees that reliably throw versus those that don't? Specifically, the authors looked at the ratio of two different types of brain tissue, white matter and gray matter, in the areas of chimpanzee brains that would be most similar to the areas of the human brain involved in motor control for throwing and for speech. And this would be, quote, the homologue to Broca's area. Remember, again, Broca's area is involved in speech production in humans. And then they also say, as well as the motor hand area of the precentral gyrus, termed the knob, K-N-O-B. And what they found was that in both of these areas, in the chimpanzee equivalent of Broca's area and in the knob, the ratio of white matter to gray matter was higher in chimpanzees that throw versus those that don't. Also, quote, we further found that asymmetries in white matter within both brain regions were larger in the hemisphere contralateral to the chimpanzee's preferred throwing hand. So, what they're saying is it's not just that the ratio of white matter was higher in these regions on both sides of the brain. It's that whichever hand the chimpanzee liked to throw with, those particular regions had a higher proportion of white matter on the opposite side of the brain. Also, they assessed the chimpanzees in this study with what is called a primate cognition test battery, or PCTB, which is sort of an SAT for chimpanzees. It's standard tests on all kinds of mental abilities, you know, tons of things, spatial memory, causality inference, tool property recognition, gaze following, and so forth. And they were looking at, well, are there any differences between apes that throw and apes that don't throw? And out of this entire test battery, generally not. Generally, there were no cognitive differences, except in one area. There was only one aptitude where there was a significant difference. And it was that researchers found chimpanzees that were more inclined to throw were also better at social communication. So the authors write, quote, these results suggest that chimpanzees that have learned to throw have developed greater cortical connectivity, that's correlating with the white matter, between the primary motor cortex and the Broca's area homologue. It is suggested that during hominin evolution, after the split between lines leading to chimpanzees and humans, there was intense selection on increased motor skills associated with throwing, and that this potentially formed the foundation for left hemisphere specialization associated with language and speech found in modern humans. So this is another case where I think this is far from proven. We would need much more robust evidence before you could endorse this specific evolutionary story as likely. But I find this very intriguing, and it does seem possible to me that the capacity for throwing gave rise to the capacity for language.
So ape throws the bone spins around, the bone becomes a space station, just as Kubrick promised us.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. Yeah.
I want to get back into this idea of early humans, especially throwing stones as weapons and throwing other things as weapons. You know, as we discussed in the last episode, we talked about some of the ideas concerning the development of ranged weapon technology in prehistoric humans, this idea that what first begins as a way of engaging in agonistic communication could transform into just a way of physically sending a message to another species via projectile. But then eventually that begins to get into this way to manipulate their behavior at range, especially in the case of power scavenging. And ultimately, it could be used as a way to hunt prey animals.
Right.
And as we were actually recording that episode, my mind kept turning to these images of some sort of prehistoric warfare scenario in which some, you know, entirely too Kubricky prehistoric people were employing various weapons and kind of probably a slightly too tabletop war game manner where you have, you know, units of bone wielding beaters moving forward to engage in some melee attacks. And then maybe you have some units of rock throwers behind them. And, you know, this felt kind of silly in my head, maybe even a little Gary Larson esque in my head, a little Far Side. But then I started looking into it more because, of course, you know, rock throwers were an important part of our history. And when you start looking into the history of not only ranged weaponry, but hand-thrown ranged weaponry, it gets pretty fascinating.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think one of the main things that's striking is rediscovering how potent a force simple thrown objects are, even in an era where powered projectile technology like bows or crossbows or even guns exist.
When you think of, oh, somebody's throwing rocks, there at least can be this sort of feeling that it's like a juvenile sort of thing, that it's primitive, that it's a nuisance. But on the other hand, I think most of us realize that it's also quite dangerous. Nobody wants to be hit in the head with a thrown rock. A well-aimed thrown rock can, of course, be deadly.
True.
And on top of that, a volley of thrown rocks from multiple assailants, even more dangerous. And of course, we see this reflected in the use of stoning as a form of execution from ancient times through modern times. But I didn't want to dwell so much on that because that's a more depressing subject matter. But I wanted to focus more on hand-thrown stones and weapons in a hunting and warfare context.
Okay.
So I think for many of us, and this was me until just the other day, we tend to think of ranged weapons as this steady ascent out of the Stone Age. So sure, we threw stones at things, then, and we greatly increased our ability to strategically employ those thrown stones. But then we got wise, and then of course we probably got wiser about how we selected stones, granted. But then eventually we're going to level up, right? You're going to upgrade to using something like a sling, a spear thrower, a bow and arrow, a crossbow, etc., all the way up through the modern era. And I think it's easy to think of this as a linear progression or like a video game skill tree, a situation where you're yelling at the screen, hey, don't equip the throwing rock, you fool. You have a spear now. Equip the spear.
Yes. Video game logic pervades our thoughts in every way.
Yeah. But of course, this is not exactly how things pan out for a number of reasons. Speaking broadly in terms of just weaponry in general, materials are one factor, and we've discussed that on the show before. But another huge factor to consider is that humans are such great natural throwers, as we've been discussing, and it's such a big part of the weapon history that there just may not be a good reason to completely abandon the hand-thrown stone.
Right. I mean, you can imagine cases where people are having great success with just hand-thrown stones, and why fix what's not broken?
Yeah. And then if something also becomes a part of culture, becomes a part of a martial art, and a weapon tradition, then there's this added incentive to keep it around. So I started looking into some examples from Polynesian weaponry and martial arts. The first thing I ran across was an interesting mention in The Coming of the Maori Weapons, a 1949 text by New Zealand anthropologist and Dr. Te Rangi Hiroa, who lived 1877 through 1951. In discussing the prevalence for spears and clubs in Polynesian history, he also discusses the sling as a primary ranged weapon along with the spear, and then he shares the following. Quote, stones were also thrown by hand, and early European voyagers have reported this form of attack more than the use of the sling. The bow and arrow, while present in some groups, was used for sport but not as a weapon of war. In Samoa, it was used to shoot pigeons, in Hawaii to shoot rats, and in the Society Islands, it was a chiefly sport in which archers clad in special costume shot for distance from raised stone platforms. Now, obviously, this is an older source here. But instantly reading this, you realize, well, if this is true, it raises interesting possibilities about the dependability of thrown stones as weaponry, even as other technologies come online.
Right. So you could have the technology of a bow, but still prefer hand-thrown stones for some utilities.
Yeah. And the advantages of the bow, of course, are well documented. You know, none of this that we're getting into is going to be a statement that along the lines of, well, actually, a thrown rock is better than a high-powered bow or anything like that. But and it's true that the use of the bow was widespread, not only in ancient armies, but among hunter-gatherers. But as Thomas Hewlett points out in a section on ranged weaponry in the book 70 Great Inventions of the Ancient World, not all hunter-gatherers used the bow and arrow. He mentions Australian Aborigines as an example of a people who did not, despite some of them surely being aware of the technology via contact with the Torres Strait Islanders who used bows. They were still people that that retained the use of ranged weaponry that depended on hand-thrown objects. And we'll come back to the most famous classification of hand-thrown objects that they used in a bit. But where I really got fascinated with all of this was a paper from 2011. This was published in the Journal of the Polynesian Society by Barbara Isaac and Guineria Isaac, titled Unexpected Trajectories, A History of Niuean Throwing Stones. The authors here describe the war stones of Niue. Niue is an island that's 1,500 miles or 2,400 kilometers northeast of New Zealand. And when Captain James Cook visited the island in 1774, he dubbed it the Savage Island, which may have had something to do with their consumption of the native banana species, which I'm to understand had like a red peel and an orangish interior, and if in the teeth or rubbed on the body might look like blood. But this also clearly reflects Cook's general attitude towards indigenous peoples as well. But he also certainly seemed to have encountered some difficulty in landing on Niue. It's apparently difficult to land on the island anyway due to the surrounding coral reefs, but the people of Niue were also hostile to his landing attempts, and his naturalist, the naturalist on this particular voyage, Anders Sparman, was injured by a thrown stone. I believe it got him in the arm.
Mm-hmm.
The Niue here, they were not just picking up random stones and throwing them either. This is where it gets really fascinating. They had a highly refined approach to the use of hand-thrown ranged stone weaponry. According to Isaac and Isaac, the warriors were reported at the time to each have spears on their person, to have a sling, and also have a pouch of stones for throwing. But throwing stones and sling launch stones were not uncommon among other peoples who were encountered on islands from this vast region. So comparatively, there wasn't much Western commentary on these throwing stones. But the throwing stones of Niue, according to Isaac and Isaac, were quite singular. And much of it would come out later through indigenous recollections, the work of later anthropologists and missionaries, as well as later analysis of stones that were subsequently taken off the island after Western contact.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So these war stones, the crazy thing about them is that, again, these are not just stones that were picked up or even stones that were sort of painstakingly collected in the way that one might scour the rocks by a stream to find the best rocks for skipping. No, these were crafted items made of, I think, predominantly limestone.
Crafted items. So you might think of this as more like an arrow or an axe head or something, but it is a stone for throwing with the hand.
Right, right. The people here would harvest the stone apparently from stalactites and stalagmites in naturally occurring caves on the island, and then wear them down into the desired shape by working them over with other pieces of stone or with pieces of coral. So we're talking a considerable manufacturing effort going into these. Again, they're not just picked up off the ground. They're not even scavenged from the ground. They are manufactured from materials that are harvested. They tended to weigh around 3 to 4 pounds each, and they were largely spherical in shape. They were often compared to small cannonballs by Western commentators. But the difference is that they were elongated a little bit on the two opposing ends. You can look up pictures of these online, and they, to me, if I was to compare them to a naturally occurring object, I would say they kind of look like well-crafted stone lemons or limes.
I was going to say lemon, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, they have that, or I guess you could almost say they don't really look like a football, but they have, I guess, a slightly football-esque shape, or they remind me of certain, like, malformed, or not malformed, but sort of slightly unrealistic toy footballs you might have seen if you were a child, back in the 80s or something.
Sorry, I was just briefly amused by the concept of a toy football.
Yeah, well... Well, you have the functional football. This is for serious business, for the sport of American football. And then you have something that's less serious.
This is a football. This is not for playing with.
So you did have Western observers, though, that were figuring a lot of this out, that these war stones were indeed crafted items, that they were made out of limestone, that people would harvest the stone from, again, stalactites and stalagmites. And there's some really interesting takes on this that are reported in this paper. In 1868, missionary Thomas Powell wrote that, quote, "This fact is remarkable as an indication of thought and design natural to this people, for it is not probable that the first inhabitants brought the ideas with them, but they found this limestone in the caves, saw the use to which it might be put, and designed the shape. It is therefore original on their part, and in this particular, they anticipated the European science of the recent century." Now, they don't note what he was referring to here on the European science thing. So I'm thinking maybe airships? I'm not sure. They kind of have an airship look to them, I guess.
Hmm.
Now, on the limestone front, 19th and 20th century anthropologists described other war stones that were sometimes used that might have been made of other materials, one of basalt, one of coral, for example. You definitely have examples of like a black stone, a black war stone. But limestone seems to be the primary material. They were highly prized and were used exclusively for conflict. And there was apparently a lot of conflict on the island. This is before there were any Westerners even. And part of it had to do with, droughts would occur, and there was a lot of skirmishing for available resources.
Hmm.
But they didn't hunt with them, apparently. So birds were hunted with what are referred to as bird bows in this paper, and fish were hunted with nets. So these were exclusively for dealing with human threats or perceived human threats. Warriors would carry them in bags or on belts. And if they ran out of ammo, it's mentioned that they would naturally make use of stones from the ground as well. So they weren't above, reaching down and grabbing whatever was available and throwing that after your special stones were extinguished. And then, of course, after a skirmish or battle, you would hopefully be able to go back and pick up your ammo, retrieve them, because other sources mentioned that they had names, they had histories of violence. And so these particular stones would kind of resonate with importance to the individual who wielded it.
Hmm. So it's interesting that if the stones are, they're manufactured with care and they're used specifically for human conflict instead of hunting. I mean, it makes me think about them having, I don't know, some kind of special like communicative or signaling power in addition to their ability to hit and hurt someone.
Yeah, I think so. Here's another great quote. This one is referenced in the paper as well from anthropologist Edwin Loeb, who wrote the following about the importance of the stones to the individuals. Quote, "The fighting stones all had special names, and they were put in a kafa, or girdle, which was plaited like a mat. The kafa was about 6 to 7 inches wide and was customarily 4 fathoms in length. The third night before the war arrived, they wound the kafa around their stomachs and slept in this manner during the night, neither eating or drinking." So in this paper, the authors here, they point out that these Niuean stones, these war stones, there were songs about them. And part of their importance also may have had to do with the fact that they were products of the caves, which were sacred sites with, seems like, connections to the afterlife. And of course, this matches up with the way caves were viewed by peoples in other parts of the world as well. The stones were used in ambush attacks, in skirmishes, but also sometimes in fights to the death would occur. But it seems like a lot of these battles, based on some of the commentaries, may not have been typically that lethal. This does line up with this idea of communication. It's not necessarily about going out and absolutely murdering the competition, but driving them away from resources that you're looking to control.
Mm.
And in the paper, the authors also mostly speculate on accuracy here. And in part of this was based on accounts of other throwing techniques by other advanced stone or club throwing groups. But they speculate that high accuracy was likely within 20 yards or 18 meters roughly, but greater distance accuracy was certainly possible. And I think this makes sense when you consider the likely scenarios in which these stones are being used. Any kind of sort of tabletop gaming scenario that you have in your mind, you should probably set aside. It sounds like most of these encounters, these battles, would have involved like one individual against another individual or one small group against another. It seems like skirmishes and small ambushes were sort of the typical encounter context for their use. So anyway, it's a fascinating paper. It's available on JSTOR if anyone wants to read more. They really get in depth about the history of it and various mostly Western commentators who are looking at it, and also how the use of the stones was disappeared, and then the stones went out throughout the world and then were to certain degrees brought back or studied. Now, this was certainly the most, to me anyway, remarkable account of stone throwing I came across, but not the only account of specialized throwing stones. I ran across the work of Guy Steibel talking about archaeology finds in Jerusalem and the accumulated weapons and ammo that they were finding. This was a paper that came out in 2013. This is from a chapter titled Military Equipment in a larger collection of papers titled Jerusalem Excavations in the Tyropian Valley. And so there's a lot of discussion of things like things you would expect to find, sling stones and so forth, other types of projectiles. But then there is an interesting part where he mentions, he starts talking about what may have been stones that were expressly collected and even crafted for throwing. Quote, "Three flint balls have a single flat face, unlike weights or grinding stones that frequently exhibit multiple flat surfaces. They were ideal for heaping on top of battlements, as modern experiments have demonstrated. In light of parallels from both Palestine and the Roman West, it appears that the use of hand-thrown stones was much more prevalent than has been previously appreciated in modern scholarship."
Oh, that's interesting. The single flat face. So that would be a stone that was modified or selected to have a single flat face in order to make it easier to stack in a pile and so it wouldn't roll away?
Yeah, yeah, for use on battlements, which I guess also the other side of that is not only do you not want your ammo to roll away, you don't want it to roll off the battlements with fatal gravity assist, potentially, if you're not meaning to drop it. I'd never thought about this before. I've certainly researched siege scenarios before where it's very obvious that if you have the advantage of battlements, there's a great deal you can do without the need for the power of a bow. You can just drop things on people underneath. And dropping things on your besiegers was a favorite tactic. You could drop rocks, you could drop various burning things, oils, etc., all manner of things. And again, with lethal intensity. But this idea of not just having stones, but stones that had been to some degree altered or manufactured or crafted in order to just stack up there. So they're ready to go, but they're also not rolling out of sight and posing a danger to anyone who might just, say, be working beneath.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, there are also several interesting cases, probably many, many more on top of what I'm going to highlight here, of hand-thrown clubs and throwing sticks. So, you know, we've been talking about throwing rocks, but of course, throwing sticks is just sort of the other side of the equation here. And you find examples of these traditions just throughout the world on various continents. The throwing stick was used as a hunting tool by prehistoric peoples, and we have examples of these going back at least some 300,000 years. One of the problems that, and this is something that's pointed out in a paper I was looking at by Conrad et al. In Nature, Ecology, and Evolution, is that a throwing stick is generally a wooden stick, and therefore it's not always going to survive to become an artifact that can be studied and interpreted hundreds of thousands of years later. Mm-hmm. But the practice of hunting with thrown sticks certainly survived. The ancient Egyptians retained a practice of hunting with throwing sticks, and we see this commemorated both in their hieroglyphics, but also in art. I included an image for you to look at here, Joe, where you see an individual clearly out by the waterside. There are all these birds around, and in one hand, the individual is holding up this throwing stick.
And this is sort of an end-weighted club of sorts that can be thrown.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, we also see the use of this in other cultures as well. The Hopi tribespeople of North America also used a type of hunting stick, sometimes referred to as a rabbit stick, named for the prey you would go after with this tool, with this weapon. Mm-hmm. Throwing clubs, throwing sticks were also used in warfare scenarios and also in war-related ceremonies and in symbolism. Fiji Islanders used beautiful and ceremonial throwing war clubs. These were called ulas, and you can look up examples of these. Some key African traditions of throwing clubs are notable as well, including the East African Rungu, as well as the knob carry of southern and eastern Africa. And these were used for hunting and war, but also became highly symbolic social signifiers as well.
Yeah.
But I feel like the idea of the thrown blunt weapon, the throwing club, is something that is often, I guess, glossed over in at least in the Western mindset. Just, again, coming back, as always, to things like Dungeons and Dragons, where we wrap all these fantasy scenarios around the use of ranged and melee weaponry. It's easy to dismiss the idea that, the club also is a potential ranged weapon. Though, of course, I think Dungeons and Dragons does at least have a boomerang in it. And the boomerang is probably the most famous and, I guess, the most exceptional of the thrown clubs that humans have developed over the ages. The boomerang is exceptional because it's still essentially a thrown club that kills or injures via blunt force, but it is also crafted to spin in just the right way and by virtue of its shape to generate an aerofoil, which then increases the distance that it can be thrown. So it's not only, thrown, but it also begins to take on flight in a fascinating manner.
Yeah, I remember being fascinated by the boomerang as far back as when I was a little kid.
Yeah, and according to Thomas Hewlett, we run into the wooden artifact problem again with boomerangs, but convincing boomerangs have been discovered as old as 10,000 years. So they've been around for quite a while. There are returning boomerangs and there are non-returning boomerangs. Non-returning boomerangs were primarily weapons, while returning boomerangs were, I think, more in the recreational and symbolic and mythological sphere of things, but could also be used, apparently, in hunting scenarios as some sort of a decoy for, I think, birds of prey, but also as a means of frightening intended bird prey. So they weren't without functional uses. And there are a lot of things similar to these boomerangs that we find in other cultures as well. Like the Tamil people had a kind of non-returning boomerang of their own called a Valari. And you can look up various images of this as well. Has a slight boomerang shape, kind of a tusk-like shape.
Yeah.
Now, going back to Thomas Hewlett here, he points out that, broadly speaking, the evolution of ranged weaponry was initially an evolution that had a lot to do with range. Thrown weapons greatly increased the range at which human beings may inflict harm, but then additional throwing technologies extend that range. And this, of course, increases what we can do with them from a hunting standpoint, but also provides advantages over other human adversaries, at least under the right conditions. But I think these examples show that it's not just a matter of abandoning the use of hand-thrown projectiles. We retain the physical abilities as well as the basic skill sets, and we see this reflected in our sports as well as our weapon cultures. Hand-thrown weapon traditions clearly survived the advent of other ranged weapon technologies, and in many cases retained important cultural values as well. And there's one final wrinkle here, too, that I almost completely blanked on. I almost didn't have anything about this in the notes. But then I, of course, remembered, well, as we enter into the age of explosives, hand-thrown weaponry remains important in the form of hand grenades. The more common variety of grenade is, of course, made to be thrown by hand, much like a throwing stone. It more or less fits in the human palm. Though we also have the example of the German stick hand grenade that was used in the First and Second World Wars, and I think adopted by some other groups as well during this period. But as the name implies, this design features a long handle, and these were thrown end over end, much like a hunting stick or a thrown club. Now, in both cases, obviously, given that this is an item that will explode, you don't necessarily have to be as precise. It's not a situation where you have to hit somebody in the head with it or in the neck with it every time for the weapon to be successful. Though I guess there would be situations where you were trying to throw said grenade into, say, a window or some sort of an opening in a tank, et cetera.
Well, or like in other cases we've looked at, to compel behavior, to like drive people away from a particular location.
Yeah. I was thinking about Monty Python many months back, and I, of course, thought of the Holy Hand Grenade of Antioch, the magical weapon that is used against the killer rabbit. And I remember looking around a little bit to see, was there anything in use during the general historic range that we're talking about here that would have been like a grenade? And as I recall, there wasn't really. So I guess there is maybe a potential lag. There's this kind of gap between the high age of stone throwing and stick throwing as a viable weapon, and then the emergence of explosives, which kind of reignites the need to be able to throw precisely, or at least with some degree of precision. You don't want to throw a hand grenade imprecisely, but we certainly see with hand grenades the need for individuals to throw these things becomes all the more important. I mean, you look at images of say modern soldiers training to throw hand grenades, and there's a definite form to how you do it. There's definite training in place. So precise throwing of handheld objects remains a seemingly important part of the modern military scenario.
You know, I didn't plan it like this, but it's interesting how this series began as us wanting to look at examples of non-human animals throwing. And ultimately, the main thing that I'm taking away from it is the special role of throwing in the development of human culture and human cognition.
Yeah, I was surprised by it as well. Because, we started off with the octopus, and now here we are talking about soldiers with grenades. We have to keep the grenades away from the octopuses, by the way.
Yes.
Oh, I should also point out, I didn't even get into the use of sharpened throwing weapons, but obviously that's a huge part of weapon culture throughout history as well. I don't know. I guess it felt like one step manufacturing or materially away from just throwing a stick or throwing a rock. So I didn't get into that, but obviously there's a lot one could additionally discuss involving hand-thrown axes, hand-thrown darts and knives and so forth. So I guess different aerodynamic properties come into play with at least some of those weapon designs. All right, we're going to go ahead and end it there, but we'd love to hear from everyone out there. If you have thoughts, feedback, experience on anything we've discussed here in this episode or the previous episodes regarding animals throwing things, humans throwing things, the role that being able to throw something may have in the development of language, and also just the various weapons cultures, martial arts that have involved hand-thrown objects. If you have anything to add about any of that, please write in. We would love to hear from you. Just a reminder that Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a science podcast with core episodes publishing on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Mondays, we do a listener mail, and that's where you can write in, and we'll discuss some of the mail that comes in. On Wednesdays, we do a short-form artifact or monster fact episode, and then on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a strange film on Weird House Cinema.
Huge thanks to our audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, to share something interesting, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.